Hello and welcome to the 15th episode of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and resilience, where we live, learn, and work. Hello, I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. And wow, are we in for a treat today. I am thrilled to be interviewing one of my mentors and long time friends in the work of suicide prevention, Dr. Paul Quinette. And I'll be introducing him in just a second. We're going to be talking about something that's really important to both of us, which is moving people from awareness into action, and doing so by creating effective trainings and ways to engage people so that not only does their knowledge change, but they actually change their behavior, which is really important when we're doing this work of building up capacity in communities so that our communities are safer from suicide. And I published, I think maybe 8 or 9 months ago, a PDF called Moving from Awareness to Action, 23 Characteristics That Make Trainings Great, were things that I had learned along the way, some from Dr. Quinette and some other folks that have guided me through this process, some just from being out in the field and seeing what stuck with people. So I just want to highlight a couple of things that I've noticed about training and also to pique Dr. Quinette's thoughts about some of these things. Number one, we really want to make training stick. It's not great to do, to present some information to a bunch of people, and then the next day they have no recollection of what you talked about, or maybe they were interested when you were in front of them, but you know, a week later they're moving on and back to usual. And so we really need ways that kind of bake it in into a strategy that makes sure that it's sticky and that it's fully embedded into health and safety priorities. So some of this is really taking time to listen to a community before you implement any training, really getting both leadership buy-in as well as grassroots buy-in so that folks can feel like it's a by them, about them, and for them. It's really important if people are in what we call the postvention state, so if they've just experienced a suicide loss, that we take some time with them first to help them process their grief and trauma before we go launching into some kind of training program, especially training about warning signs and risk factors that they may have not known about that can really contribute to survivor guilt for people who are still in the throes of their grief. We also want our training to be multi-pronged, so not just a training. We want to make sure that there are, we're looking at communication strategies and policy and mental health services quality and all kinds of other things to really make our effort comprehensive. So on one hand, we want to make it stick. We're going to embed it in a strategy. And the other thing we want to do is we want to make it come to life. We want the training to be effective. And there are a number of ways that we can do that. Again, a lot that I have learned from Dr. Quinette and where I work with QPR. But we really need the training to be evidence-based and continually iterating and improving through collection and reflection on the evaluations and the data that we have. We really would need it to be culturally responsive. And again, QPR has done a really remarkable job with that by making various versions of it in different languages. I understand it's in, you know, 7 or more countries at this point, looking at different ways that communities think about this and respond to the different training materials is really important for it to come to life. And having some lived experience components into it also does wonders to make it come to life too for the trainees. So if they see people in the training that have stories similar to their own and are telling these stories through a lens of hope and recovery, of how the skills that are being taught are useful for people in their real lives, I think that's much better than a bunch of slides that just show data points and theories. I think when we have that lived experience voice in the room, it makes all the difference. So with that overview, I would love to introduce my friend and colleague and mentor, Dr. Paul Quinette. He's a clinical psychologist and the president and CEO of the QPR Institute. I was actually trying to remember, Paul, when we first met, because it's been a while. I think you were one of the very first people that I connected with when I was still at Regis University, and we had just gotten a Garrett Lee Smith grant, and I thought, QPR, that's what we need here. So I think, yeah, you're one of the first folks that came into my world as I tried to figure out this work of suicide prevention. I think QPR at this point, you can correct me if my numbers aren't accurate, but that you've trained, QPR trainers have trained over 2 million lay and professional people around the world. That results in about 20,000 or more each month. We're going to also be talking about a new program that you're about to launch that is really using gaming technology to help people understand some of the strategies on how to keep people safer for now. So we're going to be very excited to hear more about that. And then the other thing that I really love about you, Paul, is that you're an avid fly fisherman, and you weave in your knowledge and love of fly fishing with some of your psychology. And so if we do have a chance to talk about some of your theories around kind of evolutionary psychology and fly fishing and how that relates to our conversation, of course, I'd love for you to drop that in. So without any more blabbing from me, welcome, Paul. How are you today?
Oh, thank you, Sally, and I'm just fine. I'm sitting in my little cabin in Idaho on the St. Joe River and working today. So I've been able to combine both my love of fly fishing and work and do it all in the same locale. I'm a very blessed person, so...
That sounds lovely. And oh my goodness, you're in a rural area, but your sound quality is so clear. This is not always the case for us. So thank you so much for making time today. Would you please just give us a little bit of your pathway into this work? What, you know, you had been in clinical psychology for a while, but I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about the founding story of QPR and kind of what lights your passion for this work.
Well, I think that's an excellent story, and everyone has a pathway into this work. What happened with me is I went to graduate school at Washington State University, a PhD program in clinical psychology, and I left there to an internship, and I had no training, maybe a 30 minutes of part of a lecture on suicide as a problem, not particularly associated with mental illness or mental health. But long story short, I experienced my first suicidal patient while I was an intern, and I realized at the end of my intake interview with him, he'd made a suicide attempt with a hunting knife, that I didn't know what to say to him or what to do with him. I was panicked. I went to my supervisor, and that wasn't particularly helpful. But I experienced that first patient, and I remember being terrified by the experience. And then I was took a job as the director of a startup mental health center, and in 1970, I think it was. And we grew a large staff, and over time, we began to lose some of our clients or patients, however you choose to call them, to suicide. And I was the clinical director of what came to be a very large clinical service of 400 plus clinicians and thousands of patients. And in the course of a month or 2 months or whatever, we would lose patients to suicide. And I was troubled by this because I was the captain, of, as it were, and some of my people were dying. And so about that same time, I lost two of my supervisors within 6 months, people who had trained me to suicide. Mm-hmm. These were a very able psychiatrist and a social worker who was one of my therapy supervisors. And they died by their own hands. And I thought, my goodness, what's happening here? And then I started pulling the records of all the patients who were dying by suicide and reading through them and realized there wasn't much information in the medical records. So at the time, I was operating a clinical internship in psychology for the APA, and I had four interns. And so we conducted a community study where we pulled all the clinical records of every patient we'd ever seen, looked for the word suicide through in their chart, and then checked those who had died by suicide according to county medical records or obituaries and so forth. We learned how many of the patients in Spokane County we had seen or touched or evaluated in an emergency situation and who later died by suicide. And that's when it struck me that this was a huge unexplored problem. It had hit me personally in losing two of my supervisors. And I saw what it did to staff who lost. I had a young intern in psychology who in his first month lost a patient to suicide, and it devastated him. He stayed on as best he could, but he eventually left the field. And I thought, well, this is a career-ending experience for clinicians. This can't mm-hmm. be so unknown, can't be so unexplored. So I then made a focus of seeing suicidal patients. I kept 4 hours of my total week available for seeing patients, and my staff selected them for me, and I selected them, and I ended up kind of specializing, I guess, in treating suicidal folks and having them tell me their stories, their internal journey toward this decision. And that's where I began to get the idea that the field was lacking in any kind of training or evidence-based knowledge about the nature of suicidal behavior, and that it was part and parcel of many psychiatric illnesses. So at that time, I worked with a patient, a Hispanic lady who'd made three very serious suicide attempts, and she's the one that inspired me to write that first book, The Suicide, The Forever Decision, which got me into the field, because when I wrote the book, my publisher sent me on a book tour, and I was doing TV and radio spots across the country talking about suicide, and I said to my publicist, I said, well, I'm not an expert, and she said, well, you better be. So I suddenly started reading all the journals. I found AAS. I joined immediately, and that's how I became a suicidologist, I suppose. I wrote a book, but I'd had all these firsthand experiences. And the other source is that I volunteered to help set up the first survivors of suicide group in Spokane County, and I was the professional liaison, and I'd be there part-time through the meetings over several years. So I got to see the impact on families and loved ones of those losses, which gave me another whole special feel and look into this human condition. So that's how I got started. I was teaching in a grant, and I watched clinicians being trained in how to do a differential diagnosis for depression. And they had to ask about suicide as the ninth symptom, recurrent thoughts of death or suicide, and they couldn't do it. The word would stick in their throat. They couldn't ask the suicide question. So that's where the QPR concept came from, because I was also liaison to our public health department, and realized that if doctors and psychologists and social workers and everybody else couldn't even ask about suicide, then we were never going to get anywhere with solving the problem. So the Q in QPR came kind of in a nighttime dream, and I put the two together with the P and R, and that sounded like CPR, and that seemed to make pretty mm-hmm. good sense. So nowadays, you see, the ask question is in so many of the acronyms and gatekeeper programs, and the origin story for that is, I can give you the origin for the Q and QPR pretty well. So the challenge was to get people to simply ask about it. Yep.
Yes, it is amazing. I know I do, your trainings and Safe Talk as well all the time. And people think in their head, oh, this isn't so hard. This isn't so hard. And then you get them into the role plays and they're like, the anxiety goes way up. And they really, really have a hard time, even though we've modeled it and we've talked about the importance of it. Sometimes getting the word out is really, really tough. There's another part of the founding story that I'd love people to know about, and that's your work with the frail elders in Washington State. Can you share that piece of the story as well?
Yeah, what happened was that we had a shortage of nursing home beds in our county, and our county funding source came to us and said, we've got too many people dying in their homes who are alone, and say that they've shut the heat off, the power company shut the heat off for non-payment, and they froze to death. And we have overcrowding at the state hospital for older people, and no one seemed to have a solution for how to solve the shortage of beds and so forth for an aging population. So I had a very gifted social worker on my team, Ray Roshko, who's now passed away. But Ray was a community organizer kind of guy out of the 70s. And he and I and one of our nurses came up with the concept of locating older people in their homes before they had a crisis, before they fell, before the power was shut off, and before they ended up in a hospital or a nursing home. So we basically got some money and asked for Office on Aging to help us, which they were kind enough to loan us some short-term kind of get started transfer funds. And we divided the city of Spokane into sectors, and then we hired social workers, and we had nurse teams who could make home visits. And we decided we would locate frail at-risk elders before they died by suicide or before they were prematurely hospitalized and could have lived out their days in their home. But we didn't start out to prevent suicide. We started out to prevent premature hospitalization, nursing home care. And we said, well, who knows what kind of shape they're in? And these were the key gatekeepers in our community. So who has, the question was, who has frequent contact with at-risk elders? Those are the people we train to identify and refer, which is a case-finding process, which is what QPR is as well, is identifying undetected cases in a community and getting them help before they get into some kind of terrible downward spiral. So we identified people like postal workers, water power, meter readers who had 1 month contact checking their meters. Newspaper people saw them all the time, left papers, and we trained them in signs and symptoms of failing at-risk elders. And the result was that we would go to these people's homes, a social worker and often a nurse in pairs, knock on the door, and if they wouldn't let us in, we knew it was a good referral. Because if somebody invites you in and fixes you a nice cup of tea, they're doing fine. They've already captured the health services they need. Those are the people who wouldn't let us in and who were resistant to intervention, who were resistant to help, who were most at risk. So we developed these kind of persuasive methods and returning day after day and building a relationship through a crack in the door. And then we could get inside and we could assess their everything from their physical health status to their needs for medication. We would find medications they were taking from the Nixon years. I mean, it was a mess. And so I persuaded our family residency program to take real doctors, young doctors, into these homes. I persuaded the Department of Pharmacology at the Washington State University to send pharmacy students into these homes. And we brought a whole team of people to those at risk. Okay, so what happened? We got OEO money. We won a national award from the Kennedy Foundation for innovations in psychiatry. But what really happened was the suicide rate in our county started dropping. And it dropped precipitously from, you know, in the 60s per 100,000 to 18 per 100,000 for this age group, which is phenomenal.
Wow.
Now, and that still goes on today. It's an untold story. But right across the border, 40 miles away in North Idaho, same demographics, same population, same penetration of older people to general population, and their suicide rate is 85 per 100,000 versus 18. Now, I don't know any program that can make that kind of a claim, but the fundamental premise was, we care about you, we're going to come and talk to you, and you don't have to call us for help. So our theoretical approach is those most at risk for suicide are the least likely to call. The people most at risk, and I'm talking here men, you know, all kinds of the high-risk groups are not going to call us. You can put a phone booth across from their apartment or across the street from their farm, and they're not going to walk over there and call. So
right.
We have to go to them. Yeah.
Enlist the Army to be reaching out and not putting the onus on the person who's struggling the most.
Right.
Thank you. I really love that story. I tell it all the time because I think it speaks very loudly to the fact that sometimes one of the best things that we can do isn't necessarily, you know, medicate people for mental illness or, you know, do the underneath the framework of mental health. Sometimes it is about mobilizing community and having people show compassion and do that reaching out work that helps people know that they're not alone and that other people care about them, that they're worthy. And I just I think it's such a great story to say, we didn't even mean to reduce suicide, but we did this thing, and look at this outcome. It's pretty awesome. And now look at where you've come from that day. One more round of story. So for my listeners, what you're learning now is Dr. Quinette is an amazing storyteller. He has all kinds of stories up his sleeves. And so I'm going to take advantage of that with this extended podcast to have him share a few more. Would you share a little bit more, too, about some of the stories that you have told me over the years about how you connect, like your experiences with fly fishing and your thoughts about, the evolutionary psychology components of your work, the what you've noticed about humankind and how that relates, human and animal kind, and how that relates to your thinking about what we're doing?
I don't know how it all relates to fly fishing. For me, I've always had one foot in the consultation room and one in the trout stream. And it's just been a part of my life since I was 12 years old, and I don't know how to take one apart from the other. But what I do know from my thinking about it is that whether it's fly fishing or whatever it is that I'm doing, I spend a lot of time alone. Not a lot, but I spend a substantial amount of time alone because it allows me to think and to follow little trails of thought that wander off, and I want to see where they go. I remember sitting on the side of a trout stream thinking about QPR and dreaming and thinking like, well, maybe if I worked hard, I could train. If we could do this in a way that involved lots and lots of people, throw a big tent, no PhDs required, and we just went after this as a human intervention of caring and compassion across the board, that maybe by the time I die, I could train a million people. No, not me, but people like Sally, yeah, and so many others. And so it was quite a celebration when we passed the first million mark. We're now approaching 3 million. And
that's wonderful.
The numbers, I have a report coming out here at the end of the quarter, but it's been hovering around 25,000 people a month. And when I say the solitude of angling and being alone and being just me and my dog for many, many years, it just was a place of, solitude and retreat. I've written a lot of books about it. I've written more books about fishing and the psychology of fishing than I have about suicide and its prevention. But sorry for my voice. It's just in a rough spot today for some reason.
We are hearing you loud and clear. It's like your form of meditation. So I'm a long-distance runner. Same thing. If I can let my brain be quieter, all kinds of cool things come to bear. And I have also had the seeds of what has come to be later bigger programs and initiatives from somewhere around mile 17. My brain's like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't think we have enough unfiltered time for our brains. Mm-hmm. And so I encourage people.
Less and less all the time.
Yes. Yeah.
So you've also been an advisor for us on the Man Therapy Project and co-presented with Jared Heineman and me at the American Association of Suicidologies Conference back in 2013, I think it was, 2012, anyway, long time ago. And I loved your and continue to use your thought process around the evolutionary psychology components of, in particular, masculinity and mental health and resilience and suicide prevention. Can you just speak a little bit to that?
Well, I think so. I've been a scientist, as it were, over the years, and I was very interested in suicide prevention. I was very interested in fishing. And I went back and read some of Darwin's work, got interested in the what's now emerged as sort of the warrior psychology hypothesis. But I wrote a book called Darwin's Bass, The Evolutionary Psychology of Fishing Man. And I wrote it after my first fishing book, Pavlov's Trout. And it took 2 years to prepare to write the book. That meant I had to really dig into evolutionary psychology. And I had a friend, an office mate actually from graduate school, who is an evolutionary psychologist at the University of New York, SUNY. And his, you know, I've corresponded over the years, testing my ideas and getting feedback from them. So I began to apply the concept of what explains particularly why men don't ask for help, because they, in all of our social marketing efforts in the Department of Defense, they say, you know, it takes the courage of a warrior to ask for help. And if you really understand how men evolved and who lived to father children over 1.5 million years, no warrior would ask any stranger for help, because a stranger represents a mortal threat, and you represent a mortal threat to them if you're a male. So the sort of male-on-male conflict is well-established historically, anthropologically, through analysis of prehistoric kill zones, battle scenes, and how young men died was through primarily, you know, blunt force trauma and stabbing and so forth, our primitive warfare. So there are a number of really good books out there that support the concept that tribalism and our sort of looking out for men, looking out for each other, requires this sort of, I always think it was the Magnificent Seven, the Guns of Navarone, Bilbo Baggins. These are all tropes about men banding together to accomplish some dangerous mission. And that rings so true for men across every culture.
Mm-hmm.
Whether,
yep.
And so how do we mine that piece of the male psychology in a way that it allows us to get inside their zone, as it were, and past their defenses so that we can help them help themselves? And what I've determined is that the best way to help a man is to ask him to help you. And you've heard me on all of this stuff before, but I happen to be rereading Shackleton's book about the exploration of South America, or the South Pole in 1910, and what happened on that really savage journey of being locked in the ice and 2 years without supplies and all of that. And one of the men, it's interesting, this is fascinating to me, one of the men becomes despairing and depressed and suicidal. And Shackleton's afraid he will crawl off in the snow and kill himself. So what does Shackleton do? He pulls the man aside and he says, the cook is tired of cooking for all these guys. You need to take over as cook.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, he's the most important man in camp. He's repurposed to a task greater than himself, and he doesn't die. He doesn't kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, that's exactly what we need to be asking young men to do. And
yep.
If you look at the historical suicide rates, the rates were horrible all through the 30s, and then we hit World War II, and there's Uncle mm-hmm. Sam pointing at you through a poster, we need you. It doesn't say we want you, it says we need you. And the rates mm-hmm. start to plummet. And what we have now is so many thousands of men who feel useless, who feel a burden on others,
yep.
who feel they can't, they don't have pride. There was a study done by Harvard in the 20 years ago about the Great Depression, and what women said about their men who had lost their jobs, and it's chilling. You know, things like, he's just not the man he used to be. He's not the man I married. You know, and all these signatures that this man I love is failing, and I can't help him. And I see it coming. I'm working with farm departments now, and
yeah,
trying to head off what's coming with these tariffs and the loss of profitability in the milk community in the New York State, and the milk farmers and the soybean farmers, and out here in the West, the wheat farmers, they're all going to be under duress, and we really need to be out there in the fields with them, looking at their old tractors.
And the other part of the evolutionary theory piece is they band together to conquer something larger. So I'm a huge, huge fan of peer support in men-dominated spaces. So we've seen this in first responder communities for a long time, but now we're seeing more of it in construction and in you know, transportation and other places where people are like, it's a really big step for me to think about going to professional mental health services, but I'm feel pretty comfortable, you know, getting what I need to get to be helpful to the rest of my team here, to help a buddy out. So I
well,
love
we're doing,
how
yeah,
that
we're
all
doing the,
together.
We're doing exactly the same thing with transportation and with pilots. They want peer support. They don't want to go to a mental health professional, and they won't go. So what does that mean? It means we train that peer support person
right.
to head off these things before they get any worse. And they're more than willing to do it. They get it. They understand this is taking care of their guys. And I just wish the marketing folks would get it that whenever a depressed man, especially a vulnerable man, has to ask for help from a stranger, as you know, he hears banjo music
mm-hmm.
from Deliverance. There's fear and terror and all of that, and it's way been underestimated, and it hasn't been researched thoroughly at all.
Right. Speaking of research, can you talk a little bit about the science supporting QPR and some of the things that have been discovered as the researchers have been looking into its effectiveness, and then also kind of the science of your new efforts around gamifying some of the training so that people are engaged with it and demonstrating learning?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I'd just like to say that because the knowledge base rate is so low, almost any effort to improve knowledge about suicide will show significant gains. The areas that have been studied, and particularly with regards to QPR, is changes in attitudes toward the subject and in knowledge about the subject and in skills, skills to actually do an intervention that's been prescribed as it should be safe and effective if you do these things in this order. And here are some things not to do. So our position was that we would turn over all our materials for independent evaluation by university professors and researchers and teams. So most of our research has been done by the University of Rochester staff and faculty around the suicide prevention issue. And they have, we basically say, here's the protocol, here's the content, and here's the expected results, and please conduct independent studies. And so that's been done. We've kept our fingerprints off the data. We've never seen it till it's published. And we have shared broadly both the classroom delivery model as well as our online option for gatekeeper training. And the results have been consistent. They've been significant throughout. There have been no – this is hard to believe, but we have had not one single complaint or threatened lawsuit or ask for records or anything from any third party or even first party. Anyone that's ever had a complaint about this training program in 20 years and in almost about 3 million people now. So I'm publishing an article in Crisis, the Journal of Crisis, pretty soon. It's been accepted for publication, and it talks about this issue of when you have no data for a phenomenon, that's also data. So if asking the question about suicide is so fearsome, there ought to be consequences that we could see as a result thereof. In other words, if you ask your patient about suicide and they kill themselves, then you would have a data point that asking about suicide is dangerous. So now I look back and I say, well, wait a minute, I've gone 20 years without anybody with a complaint yet. So that absence of data is sort of like the story behind the returning British aircraft during World War II that were shot full of bullet holes. Then the Germans were shooting down, waves and waves of aircraft. So they asked the scientists, where do we put new armor in the aircraft to keep more of our planes making it home from combat? And there was an Hungarian mathematician said, well, you put the new armor where there are no bullet holes. In other words, the craft to make it home, wherever they're shooting them there, they're still getting home. It's where they don't have any bullet holes under the engine or cockpit is where you need the armor, because those planes aren't coming back. So they use the absence of data as data for a major life-saving intervention. And I'm trying to make that same argument. If asking about suicide isn't harmful, then why in good's name can't we all learn how to talk about this in a way that allows people to, explore their despair and what's happening in their life with somebody? So for that reason, QPR is kind of becoming a universal intervention, in that you could ask anybody who appears to be in distress and start the conversation and even ask that question. And if it's said, no, I haven't thought about that, you're not putting anything in their head, but you may open up a problem around their eating habits, or they're going through a broken relationship, or the mortgage company's breathing down their neck. You could open up all kinds of areas of pain and suffering that people are currently not sharing.
Excellent. So I actually am going to pivot to a different topic, and then I want to come back and have you talk about the maze work that you're doing. I want to pivot because I know there's another shared passion of ours, which is about promoting the stories of hope and recovery among people with lived experience with living through suicide intensities, suicide attempts, suicide and thoughts and feelings and so forth. And so I want to thank you publicly first and foremost for your award, your contest, your writing contest that you support in the American Association of Suicidology, and really giving people with lived experience a platform to tell their stories and craft them in really effective ways. So thank you for that. But I know that this stage, a lot of people are nervous still about that, even though we know about the Papageno effect and some other things. How can we help reassure people that, you know, sharing stories that are positively framed around, you know, the turning point and in the transformation and the lessons learned and the coping and the resilience, how those can be absolutely influential in helping people stay?
Well, you know, I don't think I can give any total assurance that telling these stories is not going to be challenging to audiences or difficult for people to hear. I don't think they ever have been. My desire behind it was to have these voices heard, that they've gone unheard, and then nothing mm-hmm. great can ever really happen until it becomes a human story to which we can, to which we feel bonded and somehow obliged to do something. I go back to where did the American Cancer Foundation start? And you have to go back to 1952. Happy Rockefeller's wife told her personal story of breast cancer. And that single Life magazine story changed the entire landscape of cancer research in America. And I don't know what it'll take to change the way the entire population thinks and talks about this subject. And I can't say that it'll always have a good effect, that it won't upset people, or that they'll. But I firmly believe that you can't make anything worse by talking about it. I'm not sure I understood your question entirely, but
oh, that's all right.
My
I
reason
actually...
for doing it was simply because if we can't even ask about it, how can we even hear the stories? And yet my personal journey was that I actually listened to these stories. I would just, as we call it in psychology, report. It means shut up and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And as hard as it is for me to shut up, I did learn how to do that and to hear these mm-hmm. stories. And they were fascinating and entirely human, entirely understandable. I'm glad I did it, and I hope it has a positive effect. And I think we need more stories. We need more intervention stories. We really are desperate for those, and I'm hopeful those are coming soon. So,
well, they are. I feel like there's a lot of pockets of effort when we look at Desiree Stage and Kevin Hines and a number of people who really try to empowering people. But I do think there's more than it just feels good to kind of lift up these incredible voices and have them illuminate a hopeful pathway through it. And I'm going to have later on this year, Dr. Thomas Nieden-Krokenhauer talk about the Papageno effect and how that is mm-hmm. a very powerful way to shape a positive narrative. We also have the research by Patrick Corrigan that looks at what has had the most powerful effect on eradicating stigma or reducing stigma. And, you know, he looks at awareness building campaigns having a very time limited effect. He looks at what he, I don't remember exactly what he calls it, but something about a punishing campaign, like you're doing it wrong, having a negative effect that actually increases stigma. And he says the only thing that really has sticky reducing stigma outcomes is what he calls the contact experience. So when you're actually getting to know someone who is living with some kind of stigmatized condition, you see the humanity in them far more than you see the condition anymore, and you understand the condition through a whole different lens. And so there is some research out there that supports that work, but it isn't all stories. You are correct. It's not all stories, and there's certainly ways that we can tell these stories that can be triggering or that can be damaging or harmful, that we really need to help people shape their stories through a lens of safety and redemption and transformation. And so anyway, I just wanted to thank you for that work, and hopefully we'll get more and more of these out so that people can see, yes, there's a way through. Let's go back and talk about your new online work, which I did go around and kick the tires on, and I love it. The gaming it's more than awareness, kind of testing out ideas and developing plans for and resilience for men in particular. Can you talk a little bit about the backstory on that and kind of where you are and the science that supports your work there?
Well, it's good. What happened in my I trained thousands of people over the years, and I was training director for APA, and I've done all kinds of training. And primarily it's been lecture, you watch, you listen, you take a quiz at the end, and maybe you learn something. And the research is pretty clear that most of what students learn in an hour-long lecture is learned in the first 15 minutes, about 80% of it, and the rest of it's all a wash. Also, when I was last lecturing, is watching the heads of people while they watch a football game on their smartphone, and that drove me crazy. And so no matter how talented a lecturer you might be, the traditional approaches to training and education seem to me to be very limited. So there's a theory called constructivism, in which the learner's experience is primarily, I call it Pleistocene in nature, it's trial and error. The student interacts with the content almost entirely. There's very little lecturing or reading. It's all engagement. And you are provided a number of learning things that we know to be true and effective, which is immediate feedback, customized feedback, the opportunity to acquire a new language and master that language in the course of the learning episode, and so forth. So what I sent you as a trial is a very long 160-screen learning experience designed to try to help men get through a suicidal crisis if they're thinking about suicide. That was a whole different project than what is in the works in terms of this new software. We've named it MazeTech. And it's I have a young engineer guy that I work with. He actually works for the government now. We are developing and testing this software to teach things like QPR gatekeeper intervention. And we're lucky to have SAMHSA funding a random clinical trial right now in which one of the arms receives an online interactive role play with someone in distress, and they need to go through the QPR steps as taught to get to the resolve and get the person in a safe place. And so you open the screen, and the screen has a challenge in it. You've just received a text from someone you know, and here's the text. How do you proceed? And then you're given choices. And if you make a poor choice, you get immediate feedback as to why that's a poor choice, and you can make another choice. And you do that until you get the right choice. And then you move to the next screen, and you get the next event happening and the next communication. And it's a simulated QPR intervention entirely online in which we can count, and we have very granular data collection. Every single question, how long it took you to decide, how many errors you made, what was your error to correction, correct response rate, and so forth. And it's what the software is very clever in that it has a timer on it. So I have one I just finished the other day. You're a crisis line worker. You get a text from in a chat, and the woman says, "I've just taken all my medications. If anybody cares to save me, now's the time." And then you have to respond to that emergency, and you have 5 minutes to save her life.
Mm.
And so you have, and if you ask stupid questions, the time slips away. The time slips away, and eventually, you end up with an out of time message, and you can start over, and you can redo, you can retake that learning maze as many times as necessary to reach criteria. Now, what's criteria? Well, I don't know, but what we could do is take experts in the field, have them take the maze and benchmark their data and say, you know, the average crisis line expert worker saves this woman in 3.5 seconds, or 3.5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And so now your target is excellence. You want to be as good as the experts. I did this. I did a maze for Ireland. I just did one for India, and we put them on timers. So you got 3 minutes to master 10 facts about suicide prevention in Ireland. And I had our colleagues there, Sean and others.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm.
And
so they can complete the maze in 1 minute. So if you're an Irish member of parliament and you want to take the maze, how much do you know about suicide in your own country? If they can't finish it in under 3 minutes, then they're not as smart as some of the people in their country. And so you can keep taking until you achieve expert status. So the purpose of all of this is called active training, active learning, and it is decision point learning, and you have to make a decision, you have to take action, and you have to learn from your mistakes and so forth. The beauty of this is that in our state, we had a requirement come in on the mandatory training for mental health professionals, and somebody said, we need 30 minutes on non-suicidal self-injury. Well, who decided 30 minutes was enough of what content delivered how? I have no idea, but I had my own content that I developed for lectures in that area. So I developed two mazes. One is a tutorial on what is non-suicidal self-injury and what interventions have been proven safe and effective. That's a tutorial. The second piece, and that took a non-expert 23 minutes to complete. So then I thought, okay, I need 7 more minutes. So I developed a maze that says, recognizing warning signs of non-suicidal self-injury. So what are burns versus cuts versus long sleeves in the summer, and all those kind of warning signs. That maze also took more than 10 minutes. So I had my 30 minutes met, right? I met the requirement of tutorial and warning sign recognition, and I had them done it, and so they met the 30-minute requirement. Well, I have a psychiatric nurse friend who was an expert in this. She completed the mazes in 7 minutes, both of them.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, now this starts to pay off because she's demonstrated to her licensing board that she's competent in this area. She just saved herself 23 minutes of non-useful lectures.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden my accountant and my lawyer, they say, can we get this for our mandatory training? And the system actually is agnostic. You teach any content with it.
Yeah.
So it's just fun, and we're still very much in the development and testing, but I'm building out a number of evidence-based skills for suicide prevention workers, like on continuity of care, means reduction, things like that. They're all maze-based training, and I'm very excited about it. It's a lot of fun for a guy my age.
Can't wait to see more of that coming out. So I'm going to kind of just go back and review some of the highlights of our conversation today, and then I'm going to come back to you for some takeaways. So 3 or so ideas that you might have, especially around lessons that you've learned, that what makes training effective from your standpoint. For all of our community folks out there thinking about embedding a training into their comprehensive approach, or workplaces, faith communities, and schools, these systems that are now starting to lean in more and more and trying to make this work part of their health and safety priorities, what should they be thinking about in terms of what makes a training most effective? So think about that. I'm going to come back to you in just a second. So we started off the conversation talking about your pathway into this, and I really want to acknowledge and thank you for continuing to be a leading voice that shatters the myths that clinicians are not impacted by suicide. I mean, we never get any training about this. We never get any preparation about it, about the fact that we too are experience suicide loss among our patients or clients and among our family members. That we also are affected by clients who attempt suicide, and that this personal, it becomes personal, and the personal can become professional. And our hope is, rather than having it be a career-ending experience, that people learn, as you and I have from our experiences, on how we can improve what we're doing for the others who are trying to do it with us. You talked about your own experience, too, of going into these suicide loss support groups and listening to the stories of the bereaved families and how that has also shaped your thinking. So, again, listening to the voices of all kinds of lived experience, loss, people with thoughts and feelings, suicide attempt survivors, is where we need to be to improve our work. And I have always, always, always loved your connection between QPR and CPR. In fact, all the time I'm expanding it. So I love the idea that we train as many people as possible, just like CPR, in the hopes that somebody, when a crisis happens, says, "I got this," and they move in with confidence and competence. But we also know, as with CPR, that many, many people are trained. Many people are trained more than once, and most people never use it. But we, as a culture, value the fact that this is important just in case there's a crisis. And there's many other analogies that I think really help people understand the importance of a training like QPR. I also really am grateful that you have coined this idea of gatekeepers and really helped identify what we need to do for the people most at risk, those least likely to seek help on their own. How do we empower the people around them? And I always say, how do we empower the unusual suspects in particular, the people who are getting really good information, but they don't know what to do with it, they don't know what they're looking at, or they don't feel empowered necessarily to take a step towards helping somebody? That has, I think, has been one of the big pieces of magic of the QPR method and this whole idea of becoming gatekeepers. I also love about you the fly fishing piece of your life. I think it is a great model for all of us in terms of not only our self-care, but really making an intentional time to carve out solitude and quiet, being in nature. All of that has powerful renewal effects and also helps us think better. So I'm heading up to my cabin in the mountains in just over a week, and I cannot wait. I'm like, no meetings, no phone calls. I'm just going to sit there and think and write and walk and hike and do my thing. The evolutionary psychology piece is, I think, critical to our understanding of why we're feeling stuck in helping men. And so I'm really optimistic about our movements towards peer support that I keep seeing popping up all over the place. I will post a lot of things on our notes page. I'll post the Lived Experience Award, obviously stuff on the QPR Institute, some of the data from the University of Rochester and other evaluations that QPR has gone through. And I'll look for your crisis article when it comes out, and I'll throw that in there too. And then finally, I love how you are really challenging us all to reconsider best practices in learning. And you did that through QPR by really making sure it wasn't just a knowledge transfer, but that people were actually practicing and trying the skills on. And now you found a way to also do this digitally with immediate feedback that's really striving towards mastery as the goal. So all really great stuff, Paul. So back to you. What do you want to make sure our listeners walk away with? A couple of takeaways for them.
Well, I think the first one would be that any suicide prevention program needs to be culturally competent, insofar as mm-hmm. when taught, the audience needs to be able to say, this is about me and mine. And mm-hmm. so to that end, we have SAMHSA asked us to write a culturalization paper on how to customize QPR for different cultures and languages and so forth. So we've done that repeatedly now, and that's why it's traveling well in other countries. Mm-hmm. As a news flash here, we just opened QPR India with a nonprofit there that is a national focus to start up. The country is ready for suicide prevention, and we're doing cultural adaptations for India as best you can, given a huge country with huge things. But things like just the idea that this is about me. So we have a QPR for law enforcement. Yep. We have a QPR for first responders, firefighters, and others. We have some content specific to that. I just got notified Monday that QPR is being translated into Navajo, which is very cool to me. So that's one thing, is to get the message across that needs to be acceptable to the audience you're trying to teach it to. That's what Harvard calls mass customization, and it's something that we embrace, as long as the fidelity to the core intervention is maintained. The second thing we're doing now, and I just want the audience to think about this, is that a single QPR training is probably not adequate, and I know it's not adequate for a lifetime dose of confidence and competence to carry out this intervention when needed into the future. So we're working on now is what's called a certified QPR gatekeeper, is somebody who wants to go forward with more training, be a more a stronger player in their community. And that's not going to be a one-off training. It will be like a CPR licensure, say 2 years. In that time, the person will complete a robust online course, but then receive 90-day practice challenges via email. So they get a chance to practice an intervention, recognize a warning sign, get a tidbit of information. The concept was from a friend of mine who said, QPR gatekeepers need to be like fighter pilots on a carrier in combat. They need to be on the deck, engines warm. And I thought that's right. But in the moment, when you need it, you need to be able to do it. So that's our next thing. We're going to build on that SAMHSA research to extend the training and provide an ongoing support network for people who want to stay, you know, ready. Even though it's a rare event, it still, you want to be ready. And so that's kind of the message. And the last one is, of course, train everybody who can possibly sit still for 90 minutes and have them role play. Have them practice the intervention at least once. And I use the analogy here in Washington State. I'm not there today, but, you know, when I say, what's the survival rate for people having a suicide event in their community? And that survival depends on someone recognizing they're in trouble and doing something about it, hopefully a safe and effective intervention. So I ask my audiences, and you probably do too, you know, in what city do you want to be if you have a heart attack? And most cities in the world, it's a survival rate for a non-hospital cardiac event are less than 10%, 4 or 5, maybe 6%. But there's one city in the world where the survival rate is 62%. And how could that possibly be? And the answer is that 1 in 4 adults has been trained in CPR. It's said about this city that if you take a nap in a public park, you'll be woken by somebody applying CPR to you. You can't even get a nap because everybody wants to try their CPR. And it's based on surveillance. Observation, orientation, decision, and action. The OODA loop the Air Force uses. Orientation, observation of something, orientation, decision to act, and then acting. And that city is Seattle, Washington, where the survival rate is 62%, 10 times higher than any other city in the world. I was in Sydney not long ago, and I asked the audience what the survival rate was for having a heart attack in downtown Sydney, and nobody knew. And of course, it's about 6%. And I asked them where the nearest hospital was. And the point is, if people want to know what to do, it's to turn this into a norm. Turn something like you into a normative behavior for all humans. So that's enough of my preaching.
I love it. I love it, Paul. This has been so great. Wonderful for us to connect. I think as long as we talk to each other in quite some time. So always a pleasure to be with you and to hear your thoughts and your wonderful storytelling. And you just have a great way of putting things. Where can people find you if they want to learn more?
Oh, I think probably the best place is through our website. I can give you my email address. I'm happy to. I email better than I do phone because I'm not particularly good on the phone and I don't like phones. So my email address is pquinett, Quinnett, at mindspring.com.
Great. And it's QPR Institute.
They have questions about training, whether it's online. We're training now, thank goodness, finally in major corporations, which has taken a long time. A helpful, very, very helpful partner of ours has now opened us up to some Fortune 500 companies, and we're very excited to be working in those companies now. So, but questions can be fired to our website for any question at all, and we're happy to respond. And so,
cool.
Yeah, I think you have
and
that.
That's
yep.
QPRinstitute.com. All right,
yep,
so
it.
For those of you just tuning in, please come back. We've got a lot of episodes in the past and to come, so subscribe and leave us a rating and review on iTunes. That always helps us out. Let me know what kind of topics you're questioning or wondering about. I'll be happy to find some folks who can speak to that. Please also sign up for our newsletter so you can get notification of our Twitter chats and the webinars we're doing and the blogs and so on. So there's a lot going on here that can really help you, help your loved ones, or help your community. So in closing, everyone, please think about opening your heart and challenging your thinking. Together, let's take action to save lives, because we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.